Good morning. This is Loretta Bertolot. I'm at the Tulsa Historical Museum, and my guest today is Roy Heim. Roy is president of the Southwest Tulsa Historical Society, and we've just been becoming acquainted. Roy, welcome this morning. And why don't you first of all tell me when and where you were born, and tell me a little bit about your road to Tulsa.
Well, first off, I got drug in here off the street by Loretta. She's doing this really cool project of Tulsa Talks, and we wasn't really aware of it until she come over and visited with us. So it's a great project, and we're real excited to be part of it, all of our people in the Historical Society west of the river. So. So, Loretta, you just wanting to know a little bit about me.
Yes.
Well, we came up the river from New Orleans in 1951. As I think about it, I was trying to figure out why we actually came here, first off.
How old were you when you came?
I was four.
What year was that?
1951 in August. Connecting a little bit of history with that, that was during the Korean War period. Mm-hmm. And my dad had worked in New Orleans. He lived there all his life. And he built ships and PT boats in the Main Street, Main Canal area of New Orleans. And he had decided to make a move with the family, so he built a metal trailer, loaded up all our goods, and an old, I think it was a 37 Packard, and he hauled me and my three brothers up here, my mother. We had quite an eventful trip coming up along the old back roads to Tulsa, and I don't know why we stopped here. Except I guess he saw some opportunities for work. But we stopped, we stayed out on 11th Street in the little tourist court there. There was one of the little traveler's places where they had a one room with maybe a kitchenette. The only thing that I really remember about it was a Coke machine that you could get Cokes out of. You slid the neck of the bottle out of there and pulled it up through there. It might have cost a nickel, I don't know. It might have cost less than that. But that's the only thing I remember about that.
So there you were on Route 66.
There we were. Landed right on the thing.
Uh-huh.
We stayed there for a little while, and then he apparently had arranged for a business, because he wanted to start a welding shop, and he bought some materials and things and started his business right across from New Block Swimming Pool.
In West Tulsa?
And no.
Where's New Block Park?
You've made a mistake already. As a West Tulsa resident, things west of the river, including Berry Hill or West Tulsa. That place that we grew up at was the Sand Springs Line. That's Northwest Tulsa.
Now, what do you mean by Sand Springs Line?
Now, Sand Springs Line is, and you weren't here long enough, but that's the Sand Springs Line is the railroad.
Okay.
And that's what Charles Page started. He started initially as a railroad, but that's where the trolley cars ran.
Okay.
Sand Springs Line had all the little trolley stops, and I actually lived at Hale Station. Hale Station was one of the trolley stops, and it was 33rd and South, or what Charles Page Boulevard now, but it was 33rd and 3300 Sand Springs Line, I think that's what they called it. But we stopped there, sneezing here. OK, Okay, this is after the sneeze.
Okay.
So, you know, he started the business there. It's called Majestic Ornamental Ironworks. And it's right across from New Block Park, so that that opened up a new world to us. All of the kids going back and forth to swimming all the time during the summer. A lot of the time we had to work, though, even though we were just kids. We had to work in the welding shop and learn the trade.
Wonderful.
Had three older brothers, and we, I don't know whether you'd call us child laborers, but we certainly were educated during that period of time.
Now, ornamental iron was used in a lot of homes about that time, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, real popular. We lived right next to the White Cave House that is a popular historical attraction now. Ma Walker, people called her the Rag Lady. That's a story in itself. And Bill Walker. Bill worked on cars and things. But the cave house is still there. The old shop's not. It's gone away. There was a bar across the parking lot, the Rock Inn, and I've been to the bar a lot of times there with my dad. After work hours, he would go over there for a cold beer, and I'd sit there and eat pretzels and pickled eggs and other things that they had on the counter. Who knows where they came from. But we found a house that was just west of the New Block Park on 33rd West Avenue, and cut down a bunch of trees in the yard and started developing that house. It was made out of packing crates, for the most part, from the National Tank Company that was right next door. Somebody had pieced it together and stayed together pretty well. 301 South 33rd West Avenue. So that's where we came.
That wasn't unusual to have makeshift houses over there, was it?
Oh.
And maybe not just over there, but
no,
around town.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
We're talking 51, post-war. They were throwing up houses everywhere across the country because the guys were coming back and the housing boom. And then, of course, you know, when the guys came back, they were anxious to be back and start families. So there was a population boom then, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually changed the face of a lot of Tulsa as the houses were being thrown up everywhere, the GI houses, and you saw Tulsa's area expand a lot of places. So I had a interesting time growing up, like a lot of kids do, you know. I went to Mark Twain School, elementary school, walked in the snow both ways, only on very few days, though, when we had snow here. But we used to walk the railroad track, the Sand Springs Line railroad track, to and from school. Later on, I went to Madison Junior High School and then Central High School, the old Central downtown, which is now the public service companies. Offices and everything. As I grew up, I had kind of the childhood experiences everybody else does, and then worked at a couple different jobs. When I was in about 16 years old, I went and applied for a job as a pneumatic and hydraulic mechanic at one of the businesses right along the Charles Page Boulevard now. It would be 2500 Charles Page. As a pneumatic and hydraulic mechanic, got hired right away.
Yeah.
At 16 as a mechanic and welder. And that's because my brothers had gone there before me.
So was this after school and weekends type job?
Well, I got, after school, weekends, and then they actually paid me some of the time when I was going to Central in Vo-Tech classes, because I was doing drawings in the drafting class.
Okay.
So they wanted me to work there, and they were paying me to go to doing the drafting things. And that worked out pretty well. I had a little bit of cash in my pockets.
I like that. You had a chance to learn some skills while you were in school.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they got their benefit out of me, because I already knew how to weld and do these mechanical things. They learned that from my brothers. They were the same way. So brothers, I mentioned them several times. Oldest brother, Lewis Heim, he's continued on as a welder, worked for Crane Carrier for about 40 years and then retired. And then the second brother was John Heim. John worked at Boulder Bank downtown and other financial institutions. And then as we were going to retire later on in years, he decided he wanted to be a funeral director. So he spent a year at funeral director school in Dallas, came back, and now works for Mobley Dodson. They've changed their name now to another corporate name, but he still works as a funeral director. And then the third brother was Ronnie Heim, and he became a doctor, of all things. Here we were poor people.
Wow.
But he had the initiative to go to school, and his wife supported him. He became a DO, and he practiced in Sand Springs and at Tulsa Regional Medical Center, the old osteopathic hospital.
Mm-hmm. So he went to osteopathic here in Tulsa?
Right,
first training?
He did, and he just died about a month ago. He was a well-known doctor in the community, family
practice.
Yeah. Those were the brothers. Dad continued welding. Mom was a stay-at-home mom, did all the things she could to keep us in line. So they're moving on to kind of a next stage in life. I went into the service 2 weeks after I graduated from Central in 65. I got a draft notice, and I decided I didn't want to be in the Army or Marines, so I went down and signed up for the Air Force. And I was approved for the Air Force, and then I opened my letter after I was approved and said, well, I can't be drafted, I'm already in the service.
Good.
I went down to San Antonio, went where most of the airmen from this area went for basic training. And then during the selection process, after they decided what they're going to do with these new kids coming in, the guy that was running the training says, you're going to be a loadmaster. Says, no, I want to go to missile maintenance. And he says, no, you don't understand. Says, the selection is kind of my job. Says, you're going to be a loadmaster. I says, no, I want to be in missile maintenance. He says, no. He says, you're going to be a loadmaster, and I'm going to send you to school. So he did. I didn't have any say in it.
So you don't have any say?
No.
Do they do
absolutely.
That off your test or just randomly?
Yeah, they kind of look at your skill levels, I guess. So this turned out to be an outstanding opportunity, really. So,
well, what is a loadmaster?
Well, they sent me to Wichita Falls, Texas, to Shepherd Air Force Base. And we learned how to load airplanes and figure the weight and balance on airplanes. So they would fly level.
Well, that was pretty important.
Yeah, it was. So we'd learned how to do that, and we also learned how to pack parachutes and load planes, parachute loads in the planes.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize, you know, I was kind of localized in my thinking at the time. All I could think about was, here they're training me to do all this, but really had no concept of the fact that there was a huge war going on in Vietnam. I just, my vision wasn't that expanded. I didn't even realize how big that thing was. So we left, graduated for the training, and went to Abilene, Texas to Dyess Air Force Base, you know, just a few miles away. And we continued. We were making airdrops. I mean, we'd drop little bitty bundles. We'd drop big bundles. We'd drop Jeeps. We'd drop trucks.
Oh, really?
Out of the plane. And I still, you know, with all this training, I didn't have any concept of how it was going to fit in with the whole war that was going on over there. Then we had a few other nice things. We got to travel back and forth to Europe and haul things over there and haul them out. Some of them was fun, some of them was just a lot of work. We hauled missiles out of France when de Gaulle got a little upset at us and wanted us to move our missiles, so we moved missiles around.
When you're moving those, aren't you sitting on the side of the plane facing your load on those cargo ships?
You're all over it.
Okay.
But we moved these missiles, and we moved a lot of other things. And then I got my orders to go over to Vietnam. That was in March of 68, so I got to come home on leave a little while then. And then the Tet Offensive started the end of February, and the war really kicked up. They invaded Saigon and every place else along there, and serious battles going on. So that was the same time I was going over. So as soon as I got there, I started flying missions. We were flying around the clock. Just one plane would come in and the crew would get off, and another crew would take it and take off again. We flew people, we flew ammunition, we flew food, we flew bodies, we flew things that we dropped out, we flew things that we just pushed out. Flew into places where the roads were just a little bit wider than they normally would be. Our plane had the unique ability to back up. So
what plane was that?
This is the C-130.
Okay.
Still used today. Uh-huh. It's still a workhorse. But we could fly into a little wide strip of roadway, back up, unload, and take off the same direction with ever having to turn around. Cool pilots to be able to do that.
I didn't know about that.
So I got involved in the groups. We were at Quezon during the siege of Quezon, which was a horrible, horrible time. Our troops were up on the mountaintop, and they were surrounded by thousands and thousands of Viet Cong. And we would fly in between the mountaintops and threaten our way through there. And we would fly right above the runway and just extract the load out with a parachute. And just it would just yank it out of the plane. And our drop zone, or drop altitude on that, was 6 inches to 4 feet.
Above the ground?
Above the ground. So we were basically flying onto the ground, just full speed, and we'd yank the loads out. As the load came out and we were leaving, we could see forklifts coming from both sides of the runway. They would zip out of the underground, grab the load, and zip straight across the runway down into the other side where they would have big holes there.
So you're flying supplies in to support our soldiers on the ground?
Right, okay. Ammunition, food, and other things they needed.
Okay.
But they survived the Battle of Quezon, but it wasn't really a win. It was just a survival effort. I was over there a year and a half. Flew over 1,000 missions. Came back and was offered an opportunity, like all the kids coming back, to if you want to re-up, we'll give you a little bonus and you just keep flying. We'll give you some more opportunities. But the opportunity they gave me was turn around and go right back, and I didn't want to do that.
So were you ever on a plane that got hit, or were you all fortunate enough to get in and out?
Well,
okay.
We got shot up, but never shot down.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I flew a lot of missions where there was gunfire going up and gunfire coming down, even as we were threading through the mountain passes. Interesting time. I learned how to drive a road grader, which is kind of interesting. We were taking it out to a little remote location where the guys really needed to build a runway. And they put the road grader on the plane. And when we got there was nobody knew how to drive it. So I had to read the instructions and learn how to drive the road grader inside our $3 million airplane.
So that you could drive it off the plane?
So I could drive it off. Otherwise, we couldn't take off because it was too heavy. So I read the instructions and learned how to drive it and backed it out of the plane. As soon as I backed it out and got it away from the plane, we could take off.
Did they wait for you?
Well, the pilots were real happy with me.
Uh-huh. I bet they were. You'd all been stuck there.
Otherwise, we would have been still on the ground there.
Mm-hmm.
So, year and a half over there, and came back looking. That was that time when the war wasn't a very friendly thing, and all the protest, and people hated the war, they hated the military, and started hating each other. Kind of a turning point. It was also I think one of the things that really made the turning point was color. Television broadcast prior to that were in black and white. And all of a sudden, they've come out with color television. And all of a sudden, they started showing the blood and the guts instead of just the numbers. And the evening news was body counts.
That was sad.
Really made a change. People started seeing violence in a whole new light. And I think it didn't take long for them to get a little numb to the violence and get used to it. And you started seeing that not in the movies, the old cowboy movies and things, and war movies. You could see people shot, and of course they would be back next week, or when the serial continued. But all of a sudden you saw people shot and their guts fall out and things that shouldn't really be part of everyday life. But we saw a lot of things change then. Came back and started looking for a job. And it didn't take long. I found one right away. There was a lot of jobs available to people that wanted to work. Worked at North American Rockwell for a little while. I was a janitor-like on a machine shop and just kind of swept up the shavings from things where they were making airplane parts, and did that about a month before I got laid off. And the guys told me, says, "Don't worry about it," says, "they'll hire you back again." And he says, "They just do that all the time. They lay you off and then hire you back." And I said, this ain't the way I want to live. And I saw that the police department was hired. So I went down and applied for the police department and scored okay on the test. And then I had veterans preference at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I did well anyway, but I got hired and worked for a while in the dark room in the crime lab when I was waiting to go to rookie school.
What year are we talking about?
It was 1969, December 16th, when I got started.
Okay.
And then I worked there about 6 months while I was waiting to go to rookie school. And they had completed that new training center down at the on New Block Park. That's where I went to rookie school at. And I think it was like 8 or 12 weeks at the time. And then we had 2 weeks with a training officer. The first day I graduated from rookie school and the training officer picked me up and says, "Let's go to work."
Now what's a training officer?
The training officer, they selected people that had been around for a while and got along with people. So John Dildine was the name of the training officer that I had. He took me up. My first district was downtown, north side of downtown. He took me up and there were some guys standing against the building about Brady and Main. He says, "Some of those probably are drunk." He says, "Go over there and move one of their feet, kick their feet out from under them. If they fall, they're probably drunk. They probably need to go to jail." Of course, he knew they were anyway, so I did as I was told. Within a few hours of graduating, I was already on my way to jail with my first prisoner. I spent a lot of time up there.
Well, that was a good break-in experience,
I
guess.
Yeah, we made several arrests that first day. So that was the beginning of a career that lasted. I was there for about 37 years. And during that time, I worked in all of the units except the undercover unit. I never worked drugs or vice because I didn't want to. But I worked everywhere else in detective division. I worked in the homicide for a long time and did cold cases. That was probably the most interesting, challenging, and there's kind of two people that work in homicides. There's the people that work with people. They're the ones that go out and do the interviews and deal with things like that, and then there's people that deal with things, the crime scenes. And I was more of a thing person.
Okay.
So the thing person, spent a lot of time at the morgue, a lot of time at the crime scenes, because crime scenes are interesting. You drive up to one, here's your yellow tape waiting for you. Okay, the yellow tape tells you a lot of things. When you go there and you see all the officers on the inside of the yellow tape, the officers want to be in there because it's a little bit more place of importance to be on the inside.
If you're inside the tape, you're on the inside of the knowledge,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of get an idea as soon as you drive up what's going on. Something interesting to be involved. I always would go into a scene that I was called to, kind of with my hands in my pocket, because I never wanted to touch anything before I'd been there, kind of sensed what's going on. and got a feel of it, because you didn't start work until you really felt like you could and knowing what's going on. But then there's other scenes that you go to, and you see all the officers standing on the outside of the yellow tape. And those are the scenes that you're probably going to want to reach and grab a mask or a little Vicks for your nose.
The odors.
Yeah, for the odors.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on a lot of the both kinds. Worked a lot of the major scenes that we had for years. Some of them were really challenging to figure out. Some of them we never figured out because they're cold cases now. Tulsa has over 200 unsolved homicides that you go back and you pick up and you work on. They still do that all the time.
So they have an actual department that's their focus?
The homicide squad has at least one and maybe more people that work on those.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I did when I worked on there was trying to develop a gray squad, which was unique to Tulsa. And Mike Huff helped with that so much. He was supportive. He was a sergeant in homicide at the time. We had volunteers for the homicide squad, and the city, the police department has volunteers in police service. And these people are selected from volunteers that come and say they want to work. They do background checks on them, and then they can work in different parts of the police department. And
so you're just citizen volunteers?
Citizen volunteers.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so
is that the gray squad?
The gray squad was part of that.
Okay.
And we selected certain people that we run into from different walks of life based on their knowledge and skills and kind of interest and personality. We had a postman that helped us develop a database to track information, and he worked for us for years. We had a gal that worked for the Energy Williams companies in the energy field. She did a lot of management of records for us. We had a general surgeon that would come in when they wasn't doing surgeries. And he would do case reviews. We had another guy, he was the head of the graphics and department of NCOG, but he did graphic things for us, aerial photos before Google and all of the internet stuff. But we were able to, for the first time, to be able to look and take an overall aerial view of things. And he worked with me on a lot of homicide scenes. Sometimes we'd have as many as a dozen in our gray squad. And these people had free run in the homicide area. They could come in. And it took a long time, but we got to the point where the investigators would listen to them. And they'd trust them, what they're saying, because you pick up a cold case, and it's kind of hard to tell a detective that's been working on a case for a long time, says, I think you might have missed this. So you've got to really develop a personality connection before you can actually tell somebody that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned NCOG, and I've forgotten what that stands for.
Indian Nations Council of Governments.
Okay. Thank you.
They're the new city's planning department just moved over to NCOG.
Okay.
They're still active, extremely useful for area planning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Kurt Bickle was the guy's name.
Okay.
Kurt, He's one of the few people that actually went over and testified on a homicide case as a volunteer.
I find that extremely intriguing that we have volunteers working with the police department like that.
Actually, they work in a lot of areas. I mean, they've worked in undercover areas, not as investigators or something like that, but management, and have worked right with our undercover officers, the drug people, and the regular detective division. But areas like that, mm-hmm. we found them untold thousands of dollars worth of time that they spent and labor that we got, that people just from Tulsa just volunteered. So, and we were kind of unique in that we sorted them out and selected them and used them like we were using them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably still do today. It's been a long time since I've been there, so I really don't know.
Do you want to talk about some of your cases that you handle?
Well, I could talk about a few of them. I worked the Lee's Chicken case over on Sheridan, about 11th and Sheridan. One of the employees got together with his friends and decided that they were going to go rob the place. And they went over, and after his shift, he and his friends went over, and they actually robbed the place, and they took all of the co-workers of his into the cooler and executed all of them.
I remember that one.
Yeah. I worked the cooler on that. And that was the first case that actually worked, and I cleaned up a lot of the crime scene before we let anybody else in there. After we were through with moving everybody out of there and moving our evidence out, there we had to collect the bullet casings and the bullets that had gone through and ricocheted around. The scene was just really awful. But there's five people in there.
Those
we captured all of those.
And you solved it fairly fast, it seems,
yeah,
to me.
We were lucky. We did a lot of good things on that. Our homicide squad here has had an outstanding record for years. Our solve rate has been 90% or more, and it's almost unheard of, especially for the number that we've had. I mean, after Vietnam, the homicide rate seemed to go up, 40 or more a year, up to about 75. Suicide rate is similar.
Same cause?
Similar things. But we've got a good homicide squad. This one of the unique things that occurred on the Lee's Chicken was we had a canine officer that was tracking the suspects out of the store, out of the chicken place, and he tracked them through a field. We took photos of him and his dog because both of them were just covered with these little stick tights from going through the field. And we thought it was really unusual that they were done. Later on, we recovered one of the suspects in a van in Missouri. And in the van were some clothes, and they had stick tights all over. So there was a botanist from TU helped to connect the stick tights together, which was one of the parts of the case that helped to solve the thing.
Listening to you is as good as CSI.
Was.
So that's where it came from, isn't it?
So that was Lee's Chicken. There's probably a little more to tell about that, but we were just fortunate to get a lot of lucky things. We had another I'm trying to think of his name here. In 1989, we had a little boy that was kidnapped, Justin Wiles. Justin Wiles was mowing lawns in the neighborhood around just short northeast, and disappeared for a few days. And we were trying to find him, interviewed a lot of people where he's last seen and all. And his body, a fisherman found his body in Lake Bixhoma, down in Bixby. And the suspect had cut his body in pieces. And one of the things that the suspect did was to, when he cut the head off, he tied it up with wire, just kind of electrical wire. Tied the head and tied it to a rock and put it in a lake to keep it submerged. But the gases in the head, as it was decomposes, the gases made it float. And the fisherman saw it, and the investigation began. It was pretty easy to connect him as our missing person a short time later, because he had some ear surgeries, and you could connect the scars with the missing person report. It was about 10 years later that we reopened that as a unsolved case and a cold case. We were looking at it and we saw some Polaroid photos that were taken of the boys, the investigation, the initial investigation. Saw some Polaroid photos of a guy's arm. And this guy turned out to be one of the people that they interviewed years ago. And on the photos, I was looking at this, and one of our robbery detectives worked in cold cases for a little while, and he looked at it and he says, "What do you think that is?" And I told him it looked like a bite mark to me. And we didn't see any indication in any of the earlier reports where people had recognized that as a bite mark. So I had contacted one of my friends out in Perry, Oklahoma, as a forensic dentist. And that's a long story how we got to be friends. At the Oklahoma City bombing, we worked together when we were identifying bodies down there.
So you worked the Mira bombing?
Yeah, and Korean Airlines crash out in Guam and other things, but I was one of our first detectives that went over and got interested in forensic dentistry. We'll go back to Justin Wells in a little while.
Okay.
We've got to go dentistry for a little bit.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Okay. We had a homicide training session over here in Tulsa. People come in from all over. And one of the sessions in there was about forensic dentistry. And I got real interested in it. And looking at how they would compare x-rays, they would compare tooth structure and gum structure to use it for dentistry, and they actually had ways of doing that. So I started studying that, and also at the same time got interested in bloodstain pattern analysis from the same training session. I was a new crime scene guy at the time in the 90s, and kind of that launched me off onto a path of forensic training that I started going to training sessions and schools and got involved in associations that dealt with that sort of thing.
That was a fairly new
It was new
field at that time.
Well,
the technology.
For crime scenes it was. And I belonged to the International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts. And went to schools and training sessions they put on. And it was wonderful to be able to talk to people that actually had done research on it and were writing the books to go and meet those people and be one-on-one friends with them. And then the International Association for Identification and Association for Crime Scene Reconstruction. Three big groups.
You had a real desire to learn new and improved things.
I did, and it was pretty much free. All I had to do was pay to go to those classes and schools. I wound up, I was president of the Association for Crime Scene Reconstruction for a year. And it was 2001 when the planes hit.
So were you, did you go to New York too then?
I went to, we went to New York. My wife and I actually went to New York as part of the National Disaster Mortuary Response Team. And that's kind of a unique team that, that worked under different organizations, FEMA, and the National Medical Disaster System, I think is what they called it. They changed the name periodically. One of those alphabetical people. So NDMS is what they call it. So all of this, I got involved and interested in all the forensic stuff and brought a lot of that back to the department here. And I started doing a lot of those things and then a lot of our other detectives, or some of our other detectives started going and getting training in it. It really opened our eyes to things that we'd been seeing but never understood what we were looking at.
Well, you are impressing me with our police department.
Oh, the police department is really good. And the people that we have. Every once in a while, we've had a few people slide through there and get us in trouble. But for the most part, we've had some really outstanding people for years and years. Been lucky.
Yes, every town's not that
right.
Fortunate.
You're true.
You think
right.
Some of that has to do with our Oklahoma values?
It does. Oklahoma values, after the Murrah Building bombing, people across the country and around the world were really impressed with Oklahoma values and Oklahoma response. We went back and rewrote the response book on mass fatality stuff. Actually went back to Maryland and rewrote the book on it. So.
That book we hope we never use again.
Oh, I sure hope we don't. Mm-hmm. But Justin Wild's case was one of those cases. Saw the photo, the Polaroid photo, that hadn't been used anywhere or mentioned in the reports or anything else. So we started following up on that, and I sent the picture out to my friend out in Perry, Oklahoma. Small town, but he's internationally well known for forensic dentistry. Sent it out to him. He said, "Yeah, that's a bite mark." Says we got to get something to compare it to. So we had two big problems. One, the Polaroid photo didn't have any way of measuring the size of the bite mark, because there was no ruler, nothing in there that we could compare.
Mm-hmm.
So looked up the suspect in there, that the bite mark was on his arm, and he was out in North Carolina. He had already killed two kids when he was a teenager. And a juvenile, and he got out of that. He spent a little bit of time, but not much. And then he was a suspect in this murder in Tulsa, and then he left here. And he was just about to kill a kid in North Carolina when he was arrested out there. And he was in prison in North Carolina, but he was getting ready to be released in just a couple weeks. So we were on a real bad time frame trying to build a case on him. But we went and we dug up the body in Haskell, Oklahoma, Haskell County, and brought it back to Tulsa. And we took the head out and made a model, dental model of the teeth, so we'd have exact measurements and compare it. And my friend made several bite plates with that dental model.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually put them on a pair of vice grips and mounted them on there. And he would bite his patients on the arm.
Looking for a match?
Looking to duplicate. Will this provide this same image, this same impression every time? So he would have an actual study to do that. And then we compared it, or wanted to compare it to the Polaroid photo. I got in touch with a North Carolina investigator for the State Crime Bureau. And we got a warrant, a search warrant. First off, he went out to the prison and asked the guy if he could take photos of his arm, and the guy said no, which we expected.
Uh-huh.
And then we got a warrant to take photos, and he went out, and I requested that he put a ruler right next to the guy's arm and take photos of his arm with the ruler there, so we could get impression or the length of his arm and everything. And then work with Dr. Clyde Snow, who's a forensic anthropologist, or was, down in Norman, and internationally known. And the question I asked him was, would that arm change lengths as this person lived, barring any injuries or diseases and things like that? They said, no, that arm, once you're grown, it would stay that size. So we were able to use that. Then the detective or investigator sent me back these photos, and I took them down to the dark room of the police department and enlarged them full length.
Mm-hmm.
So 12 inches on a ruler would be 12 inches. And then we took the Polaroid photo and enlarged it so it would fit the ruler. And then we could start measuring the bite mark to a fairly reasonable accuracy. And the bite mark was the same length, and the measurements were the same as the model that we had got out of the skull.
The ratio worked. Mm-hmm.
So we were on our way with the case.
So did you get him before he got out of jail?
Or
was he released first?
Well, that was kind of an interesting thing. If we got our warrant and served it on him before he got out of jail, then we would have a statute of limitations on time that we had to prosecute him.
Mm-hmm.
We had 90 days where we had to prosecute him. If he was released from jail, then we would have much longer. So we were faced with this thing: do we want to risk our case by doing this. So I was waiting. I had gone to the judge here, I'd gone to the district attorney, and talked to them about it, and they said, yeah, you got a good case, except, you know, we don't want to be dealing with this time frame problem. So I went to the medical examiner's office, and I said, you know, if you go ahead and do your report and I pick it up now, I'm going to be running into problems. So as it turned out, I mean, it worked in our favor because I wasn't able to pick up the report until the day he was released. But on the odd chance that that might happen, we had a detective standing outside the gate in North Carolina when he was released. And I picked up the medical examiner's report. And when I got it, my case was complete. I took it over to the DA, the DA signed it, the judge signed it, I got the warrant, and I called out to North Carolina as he was walking out the gate. So all the circumstances just happened to fall in place, and we were able to arrest him. We brought him back and tried him and convicted him.
What a timely case.
Yeah. So he was on death row, death penalty. Of course, he's appealing it and things like that.
Something, gruesome story, but was this someone he knew or was this a random killing?
Little boy was a neighborhood boy.
Okay.
And he hung around the suspect on a car body shop, and it was called Choppers.
Oh.
But the little boy hung around there, and actually he was last seen that day hanging around Choppers.
Mm-hmm. That's
so anyway.
Okay.
That's some police stuff.
Okay, Roy, the things that has come to my mind as you've told these stories is wondering how you as a policeman, you as a man, how you deal with working cases like you've just talked about.
Well, I've thought about that a lot too, and people have asked me that over the years, because I've really walked into a lot of ugly situations, and first off, you just got to realize that people will do things like that, and you're going to be surprised. It keeps getting worse and worse the more that you do it and put yourself into the situation. Instead of looking at it as all of these ugly things, I guess that I've always been looking at it as I'm there to help the people that survived, the families, friends, and the ones that are actually victims that survive. And it's been a positive spin on horrible situations. So it made me feel good that I was able to sit and help people. And a real good example would be a case that we just talked about, the Justin Wilds case. I was able to sit in a court on his homicide case when he was pronounced guilty. I was sitting between the family of the first little four-year-old that he had killed, the second little boy that he had killed that was three, the 13-year-old that he had killed. So I was sitting there in the same group of people with all of those as he was guilty. And they said, you know, it's the first time we feel like we've gotten justice.
And that?
So many years later. And that makes it worthwhile.
Well, we're glad that men like you are, and women,
oh,
are
yeah.
on the street doing these jobs and helping it be safe for the rest of us?
Well, they've been out there, they're still out there, and in their hearts, that's what they're there for.
Okay. Just in closing, what was your rank when you retired?
Well, it's the same rank when I started. I was an officer. I worked up to sergeant and then decided I wanted to explore the world and be rich and started a construction company in Florida. Sold swampland, built in swampland, came back, become a policeman again, and started over as a rookie and ended as an officer. But I was happy all the time.
Well, thank you for coming in today and giving us your story.
Okay.